Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show that is the impeachment inquiry still continues, and Schiff looks like a bigger fool every day. You know, no matter which side you're on, there's a certain thing called proof. If you know anything at all about the Constitution, a president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. And no one has been able to come up with any high crime or misdemeanor. This is an exercise in keeping him off his game so that when the anointed one, at the moment, Biden, soon to be Hillary Clinton, runs for president in 2020, they got a chance of beating him if they can make him look bad enough. Problem is, they look like bigger fools every day. All right, we've been talking about unsolved murders, and I got a beaut for you today. This came from East Bronx. It was in the Laconia and Wakefield precincts, which is located in East Bronx. And it all began the early morning of Wednesday, March 7th, 1990. This became one of the longest and most frustrating manhunts in Big Apple history. And the first indication there was a problem came at 6:40 a.m. with a report of a man down at Wilder and Stewart Avenues in the Wakefield section. Minutes later, the first on-the-scene officers discovered 37-year-old Anton Jones, driver of a radio dispatch cab, slumped in the front seat of his vehicle. He'd been shot in the head. Well, the detectives who were summoned to the scene by uniformed personnel made their way through a gathering crowd of early morning gawkers who had been attracted to the murder scene by the police units jamming Wilder Avenue. From the various officers present, detectives assembled bits and pieces of information into a somewhat cohesive account of the shooting. It was learned that Jones's body had first been spotted by a second cab driver who had become alarmed over the inert position of the victim and put in the emergency call. An interview with the dispatcher on duty in the headquarters of the cab company that employed Jones was able to pinpoint the exact times he made his last communication. He'd radioed, he'd picked up a fare at 3000 East Chester Road and was in the process of taking him to 241st Street and White Plains Road in the Bronx. The fare would have been $6. Dispatcher got this information just minutes before the driver's corpse was found. Well, as reporters and police investigators talked to Jones's co-workers, they got a graphic picture of the terrors experienced by employees of operations that plied the streets where the main cabs refused to go. See, there's two different types of cabs in New York City. They're the medallion cabs, which is, I guess you could say, the official cabs. And then there is the other cabs. Some of them are just independent individuals who I guess you could say informally pick up passengers. According to one 62-year-old veteran driver, it's just miserable out there. How can you work when you think you're picking up the right man and you might be picking up the guy that's going around killing people? And he pointed out he'd been robbed twice. You know, any hope that his Anton Jones' slaying was an isolated event would be shattered within a week. The next one was 5 a.m. on Wednesday, March 14th. 43-year-old Elliot Whitaker, a former prison guard working as a cab driver while waiting to be hired by the New York City Department of Corrections, contacted his dispatcher. He said he'd picked up a man in front of a produce store on Boston Road in the Bronx and was driving him to the train station on White Plains Road. A few minutes later, dispatcher got a telephone call from a woman. She said, "One of your cabs hit a parked car, and I think there's something wrong with your driver." Well, the report was instantly relayed to the police, who went to East 214th Street in the Williams Bridge section of East Bronx. They found the body of Whitaker, been shot numerous times in the back of the head, which means his passenger is probably the one that shot him. On Monday, April 10th, the story was similar. Dead man was a 25-year-old student at an old college who was working the late shift to help pay for his education. Name was Paul Berghard. Picked up a passenger at Montefiore Hospital. He'd been summoned to the medical facility by a caller who'd used a direct telephone line to the dispatcher of the cab company to order a cab. Well, the news just came in. If you've been following the news today, there was a shooting in California, and one of the people that was shot was the shooter, shot himself. And according to the dispatch just came in, he died a few minutes ago of his wound. Now, going back to Paul Berghard, about 15 minutes after he picked up his passenger, according to the company manager, the dispatcher got a call from a driver for another company. And that driver reported Burghardt's cab was now at Wilson Avenue off Gun Hill Road in the Williams Bridge section of the Bronx. Burghardt was not moving. For the third time in a little over a month, Bronx homicide detectives discovered the corpse of a hardworking cabbie who'd been slaughtered in cold blood. Shot twice, once in his cheek and a second in the back of his neck. After murdering his victim, the killer had taken off with the $60 that Burghardt had been carrying. Police blotter showed he had been killed at 2:40 a.m. Well, by now, the three murders of, you know, dispatch cabs had been who had earned their livings working in the perilous early morning hours had become almost an obsession with Bronx detectives. Slayings had also set off a growing sense of panic among other livery cabbies and the driver's families. The hub of the all-out police effort to apprehend the cabbie killer was the squad room of the 47th Precinct. Here, the 10 detectives regularly assigned to the precinct, plus scores of Homicide Bureau personnel, shifted through every aspect of the three cases, looking for some type of break. According to their commanding officer, Lieutenant Anthony Vitaliano, shifts of officers were working around the clock on the cabbie killings, as they were being called. Some investigators are canvassing areas where the killer might have placed calls to the cab company dispatchers. Other plainclothesmen were continually talking to residents of the East Bronx neighborhood in which the gunman had struck. It was seeking possible witnesses on the block where the drivers had pulled over to let their fare out moments before they shot him with a .22 caliber handgun. There was one optimistic note emerging from the series of talks with cooperating residents of the areas where the slayings had taken place. According to New York City Police Department Chief of Detectives Joseph Borelli, detectives combing the teeming Bronx streets had come up with a witness who had been helpful in giving a detailed description of a possible perpetrator. And the witness assisted police artists in making a composite sketch of the suspect. Well, even as the chief of detectives revealed this information, it was said that copies of the sketch were appearing throughout Bronx. It had been placed on storefronts and lampposts. One source said the handbills were like holiday banners amid their drab surroundings. Detectives working the case agreed with their chief that the police sketch circulation represented the most positive development in the case. Still, other officers remained at precinct telephones. They were fielding incoming calls from civilians who kept the police-installed hotline ablaze with over 100 calls. Now, some of those responding to the police request for information on the killings were attracted by the $20,000 reward offered for contacts leading to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrator. Just how valuable the telephone calls would prove remained very much in doubt. Some were coming from disgruntled wives seeking to tap their husbands for the triple murder. Others just whispered a street name before hanging up. Nevertheless, the detectives on duty spared no effort as they took down copious notes relative to every incoming communication, and they followed up on every call. They developed identities from the pro-offered nicknames. They leafed through mugshots that might in some way be connected with these identities. They networked their list of informants in hopes that one or more might know the assailant. One thing the cops were not doing was going public with everything they had learned about the crime. For example, they hesitated to describe the killings to the press. Police feared that what was said to the reporters might reach the murderer. And they pointed out that in all likelihood, the wanted man either read the papers or watched TV. If he was, he might be alerted to the police activity and be able to change his modus operandi or his M.O. According to one investigator, the search is like a street fight. Every bit of information they have, no matter how small, can be worked to advantage. According to a second police source, there was another factor driving the police to play it close to the vest. Veteran officers knew in dealing with a serial killer they were working against a depraved person with a supreme ego, and they wanted to avoid any press that would feed that ego and cause him to murder somebody else. According to one person who took part in the search, we don't want to build up his credentials. Call this man a serial killer, and he'll do it again. Behind the scenes, though, the police had enlisted the aid of an expert who was developing a psychological profile of the cabbie slayer. Although at this stage of the manhunt, no profile report had been filed, detectives felt that one vital aspect of his personality was clear. As one officer put it, the way he shot those drivers, he made sure they wouldn't walk away. And although the assailant had operated within a single one-mile radius in the East Bronx, his activities caused a sense of growing panic to race through the Big Apple's garages, out of which over 20,000 livery cabs and 11,787 yellow medallion cabs operated. General feeling was expressed by the man who'd employed Paul Burghardt. Fleet manager said, "Sure, everyone's uptight. Can you blame them? We're not just dealing with robberies here. We're talking about murder, and it looks premeditated. We're looking for a man who's getting into the cabs, and all he wants to do is shoot the driver." Now, other livery company executives reported that they'd been plagued by phone calls on the day of Burghardt's murder. The drivers are calling in to tell their employers they weren't reporting for work. Some went so far as to say they didn't want to work at all. Well, livery companies advise their drivers to exercise extreme caution in making their rounds. One fleet executive told drivers not to pick up fares at Montefiore Hospital unless given permission by the office. The dispatcher said they were attempting to confirm all telephone calls requesting cab service. also telling her personnel to avoid picking up any passengers who looked in any way suspicious to them. Well, if you've ever lived in New York City, every other person you see looks suspicious in one way or another. One dispatcher reported his company was instructing drivers to demand payment of fares at the beginning of a trip rather than at the destination. He added, we're also saying if you don't like to call, just pull away and roll. And one executive said his firm wasn't going to give up its usual routes. We'll continue to drive in those neighborhoods, but if a call doesn't sound kosher, we don't go, he said. Dispatcher for the company that employed Elliot Whitaker, the second chauffeur to be murdered by the serial killer, stated robberies are much more common than killings. Robberies happen all the time, but we've only had 3 or 4 killings here over the last 3 or 4 years. And there was little comfort to be gained by reviewing the past. This was made painfully clear by the evaluation of NYPD Sergeant Frank Vigiano of the Laconia Avenue Station House, who was spearheading his unit's search for the killer. He noted that the murderer had killed for relatively small sums of money. In each of the cases, the gunman had taken only $50 to $200 from his victim's pockets. What worried Sergeant Vigiano was the fact that the wanted man had shot the cabbies to death, although in no case was any evidence that the victim had put up any kind of struggle. In all 3 instances, the driver had been shot from behind before they had a chance to defend themselves. Fear that the robber might strike again in the East Bronx was a strong possibility. According to Sergeant Vigiano, we believe it's the same person. And he knows that area. There's no question about that. As the days passed without a major break in the case, police had another worry. When a serial killer is on the loose for any length of time, police worry he's literally getting away with murder. And that may encourage other criminal types to try their hand at the same type of activity. In other words, they'll be copycats. And that fear would prove warranted. With a great deal of anguish in his voice, that one detective said, we don't have any suspects. Nothing. We're begging the public for help. Well, the bad news came in the early morning hours of Wednesday, April 11th. This time, the all-too-familiar crime scene was the East 169th Street and Sheridan Avenue in the Bronx. Victim was 41-year-old Dennis Forbes. First, there had been some confusion in the identification since Forbes' driver's license had been made out in another name. Forbes, who was a devoted husband and father of 2 young children, had been shot in the back of the head and was rushed to Lincoln Hospital. Doctors began a 24-hour battle to save him, but unfortunately, they couldn't. Just about every other cabbie in the city, Forbes had been terrified by the 3 murders that already rocked the Bronx. One grieving relative said he saw the news story about the killings on TV and turned to me and said, I have to get out of this business. Well, that statement had been made shortly before he left his home, never to return. His last act had been to set the family VCR to pick up the 11 p.m. television newscast for later development in the probe of Paul Burghardt's death the day before. As police investigated the Forbes shooting, they noted a distinct possibility the gunman who had not been the same person who had killed Anton Jones, Elliot Whitaker, and Paul Burghardt. Investigators working the Forbes case noted that in the 3 prior slayings, the killer had called the cab companies to request a cab and been given addresses on quiet streets in the Williamsbridge section of the Bronx before killing his victims. According to Lieutenant Donald Stevenson, commanding officer of the 44th Precinct Detective Squad, not to say it couldn't be the same person or persons, but at this time, certain details are not the same. It's out of the area for the other crimes. There wasn't a radio call. At this point, the shooting doesn't seem to fit the pattern. According to police sources, witnesses had seen 2 teenagers fleeing from Forbes' light blue cab following the shooting. But there was little more to go on. A 25 caliber handgun was discovered on the front seat of Forbes' vehicle as well.
Speaking to the Forbes family, close relative said, there's a lot of anger right now. We can't understand why it had to be him. They talked about Forbes' request that a bulletproof shield be put in his cab. She said it's kind of like he had a feeling something bad was going to happen. But that somebody was ready to kill for the innocent buck that Dennis Forbes had earned was obvious from the fact the wallet carried was completely empty. It was late Saturday night, April 14th. Another deserted Bronx street became the repository for the body of a cabbie who'd been shot to death while working the night shift. The driver, 38-year-old Rafael Montez de Oca, was found dead at the wheel of his car on East 188th Street and Webster Avenue in the Bronx at 11:55 p.m. This discovery was made when the dispatcher for the company that employed him got a call from another cabbie reporting the vehicle was parked at the curb and the driver was either unconscious or dead. Dispatcher told police that Montez de Oca had gone to the 188th Street address to pick up a regular passenger who was identified only as George. The man had called at 10 and specifically requested that particular car and driver. Friends of the victim described him as a quiet, reserved man who worked 12-hour days and 6 days a week to support his wife and four children. He made between $50 and $150 a day with his cab. On the day of his death, according to police, he had worked two shifts, pausing only to eat dinner. When the 10:30 call came in for him, Montez de Oca told the dispatcher it would take 10 minutes for him to arrive at the 188th Street site. They never heard from him again. They don't know whether he did or didn't pick up his passenger. One co-worker and close friend of the dead man said he was such a nice guy. It's unbelievable. It's unreal. Well, the latest slaying of a Bronx cabbie caused police to review all the open cabbie killings on their blotter. Sergeant Mary Renson, a police department spokeswoman, said that their links are being investigated. Later, police investigating Montez de Oca's murder shifted their probe into aspects of his personal life. One theory had it that there had been trouble between Montez de Oca and an acquaintance over a woman which might have provided the motivation for the killing. But the case is still open. For their part, hundreds of drivers formed long motorcades in various boroughs throughout the city, protesting the violence now assailing the hack industry. Their anger and fear was highlighted by the killing spree that continued to claim co-workers. Even as 300 cars returning from Montez de Oca's funeral drove across the Triborough Bridge during rush hour on Wednesday at 4 p.m., causing a mammoth tie-up because of their 5-mile-an-hour crawl, the death of a sixth Bronx cabbie, Bakare Sempara, native West African nation of Mali, was announced. He lingered between life and death for nearly a month after having been shot behind the ear at Underhill and Gildersleeve Avenue in the Clayson Point section of the Bronx on March 21, 1990. Police hoped he would have regained consciousness long enough to identify as assailant, but he never did. Killer's motive remained a mystery, but Detective Erlen Silverman, who was investigating the case, said robbery's a good bet. Police didn't believe Sempara's death was the work of the serial killer, but rather a copycat. However, Detective Silverman noted that many cabbies are robbed and failed to report the incidents. He said if they did, their information might help catch the killers that prey on them. And another victim, the seventh cabbie to be murdered within 7 weeks in the Bronx, was to be added to the toll. 48-year-old Muhammad Salim, a Pakistani national. He was found slumped in his cab with a single bullet wound behind his left ear in a Tremont section of the West Bronx in the early morning hours of Sunday, April 22nd. According to one source close to the police investigation, we believe it's part of the same pattern as the three consecutive murders that claimed Anthony Jones, Elliot Whitaker, and Paul Burghardt. Speculation among lawmen now was that the killer was targeting cabbies for some reason other than financial gain. Officers holding to this theory pointed out that most cabbies carry very little cash with them. The latest driver to be found dead had been discovered with food still in his mouth, his wallet empty. His vehicle with his body still in it was taken to the 44th Precinct, where forensic tests could be carried out with greater care. Meanwhile, New York City Mayor David Dinkins, the great General Dinkins, announced that he had instructed Police Commissioner Lee Brown to expand a task force of 30 officers. The augmented posse would include plainclothes cops who would pose as drivers of livery cabs in order to decoy perps bent on a fast hit. In making the announcement, Dinkins said these killings represent more than a brutal attack on the drivers who have fallen victim. They've also become an assault on a vital link in our transportation system. And all the beefed up task force now have 50 detectives, uniformed officers, and anti-crime and street crime cops. It moved beyond the original Laconia precinct area, although its prime objective remained the apprehension of the serial killer. Its new territory included the entire Bronx. The move came as police reported 16 cabbies had been killed in New York City in 1990 between January 1st and April 23rd. Police spokesman Captain Robert Civadani said a plainclothes task force would not pick up fares, but crews at night in livery-style vehicles or would tail cabs that already had passengers. A signaling system had worked out for cabbies who already had picked up fares. The department also encouraged drivers to use well-traveled thoroughfares and avoid deserted streets. Even with all the sustained efforts by lawmen, the actions of the serial killer and the others who might have been inspired by him continue to go unpunished, despite the fact that the Bronx cabbie murders ran second only to the notorious work of the so-called Zodiac Killer in the Big Apple's consciousness during 1990. And the search still goes on. Commenting on the situation, Sergeant Vitaliano, who remains the lead investigator heading the livery probe, reports that things have slowed down. A number of officers originally assigned to the task force set up by the police department, the Taxi and Limousine Commission, has been transferred to more current cases. In other words, the case has gone cold. Public cooperation has also tailed off. The outpouring of telephone calls from tipsters, which flooded police phones during March and April of that year, has now become a trickle. Well, for 1990, the number of dead cab drivers was 35, 16 in the Bronx, 7 in Manhattan, 9 in Brooklyn, and 3 in Queens. Police made arrests in 10 of those cases, and they hope they'll be able to make more arrests. But currently, they've not been able to find the person they think is the original killer. Well, the sad thing is that cab drivers, in addition to everything else, now to be concerned about if the fare they pick up is going to shoot them. Well, this next case dates from 1986, November to be exact. It involves a very pretty young lady named Teresa Ann Butler, who stepped out into a blinding rainstorm and vanished. It happened in Shelby County, Tennessee. She was 26 years old. She was a nurse, and the search became an obsession for the men and women of the Shelby County, Tennessee Sheriff's Office. 11 searches been conducted, hundreds of leads followed up. Investigators made trips to the morgue and to burial sites, convinced they had finally found the young woman. But always it came away empty-handed. According to one detective in 1987, we've had plenty of missing person cases before, but nothing like this. And yet the case refuses to go away. Police had questioned some suspects. One of them who confessed to raping and murdering the young nurse led police on several searches. Police didn't know whether to believe them or not because there are people who get off on confessing to crimes. Now, what he says about the crime makes sense and circumstantial evidence supports his claim. On the other hand, the police have never found a body or any physical evidence connecting him to the crime he confessed to and later recanted. According to one investigator, you aren't going to find a more complicated case than this one. He said it was a real heartbreaker, and heartbreak is the word. With a population of 800,000, Shelby's the largest county in Tennessee. Most of the inhabitants live in Memphis, the state's largest city and former home of the one and only Elvis Presley. The story takes place outside the metropolitan hub in the small towns that dot the state roads and highways of southwest Tennessee. At 9 o'clock on the evening of November 10th, 1986, Teresa Butler finished her shift at the St. Francis Hospital and headed for her car parked in the faculty employee parking lot. There was a blinding, chilling rain that had pounded the state for much of that day, and she likely hurried to the safety of her car without paying much attention to anybody around her. Normally, she made a habit of being aware of her surroundings and people in the parking lot, but on this particular night, she was in a hurry and apparently paid little attention. Her husband, who was a night student at State Technical Institute at Memphis, was just getting out of classes, and she wanted to beat him home and have some hot food cooking when he got there. Jamming her key in the front door of the Honda Accord, she ducked in out of the rain. She pulled out of the parking lot and drove home. Well, her husband wasn't far behind her. His last class finished at 9, and he was also in a hurry to get home. Got out of Memphis without too much hassles, headed along Monterey Road when he saw a car parked alongside the road. It took a second for him to actually register what he was seeing, but it was his wife's car. He pulled off the road, and a glance at the license plate confirmed it was her car. It's parked 20 feet off the road, and the engine was running, the lights were on, the radio was playing. She was nowhere to be found. Well, first he conducted his own search. Then neighbors later joined him, and they didn't find her or learn what happened to her. Finally, running out of places to look, he called the Shelby County Sheriff's Office. Two deputies arrived. They searched in and around the car, questioned the husband and the neighbors before reporting back to headquarters. Soon, more deputies arrived. The next morning, two dozen had fanned out through the woods and dense brush looking for the missing nurse. Well, it never fails. Everybody I've looked for all day is calling me back during my show. Well, the search was hampered by the heavy rains that had washed away tire tracks and footprints that might have been present, and the thick brush that grew along the sides of the road made it hard to search. Investigators under direction of Lieutenant Stanley White and Captain Jesse Gwynn joined in the search. These two were well-experienced officers, and they recognized this was not your ordinary missing person case. Employees at St. Francis Hospital told lawmen that Teresa was in good spirits and was in a hurry to get home to see her husband. Two said they saw her pull on her coat and dash out the door to her car at 9 o'clock. She was walking in the direction of the employee parking lot when she left. Investigators searched the lot and found nothing out of the ordinary. Hotel security had no recent reports of car thefts or assaults or of strangers loitering on the grounds. Police estimated it would have taken about 20 minutes for the nurse to drive from the hospital to Monterey Road where her car was found. That meant only minutes had elapsed before her husband driving by discovered the car. Well, the investigators couldn't figure out why she had pulled off the road. There was nothing wrong with the car. She had no reason to pull over since she was in a hurry to get home. They were also puzzled by the fact she left the vehicle with the lights on, the keys in the ignition, and the radio playing. One investigator made the comment, nobody's going to leave a car like that unless they plan to stop just for a minute. Her purse was also missing, indicating she had taken it with her when she got out of the car. Well, her husband found this strange as well. He told authorities she's very safety conscious. She had to leave the car for some reason. She would have locked that car and taken the keys with her. She's going to walk away from it with the lights and the radio on. Doesn't make sense. Car was towed to headquarters and examined. Lab techs found fingerprints and bits of physical evidence. No blood stains or signs of a struggle. There was no sign of Teresa either. Initially, police believed she'd left the car and become lost in the woods, but after a thorough search that included bloodhounds and trained trackers, they finally decided she might have been abducted. Possible scenario was that the nurse had stopped to help a hitchhiker or someone who had flagged her down. Another possibility was she was forced off the road. But in the struggle, why would they have taken her purse? Why wouldn't they have cut off the motor, locked the car? That would have made it more difficult to conduct an investigation. Police found no tire impressions or shoe prints indicating another person, but they reasoned the prints might have been washed away in that rain. Well, each passing day, police had less hope of finding her alive. News stories and a photograph of the woman were published in local papers. There were a few calls from witnesses who said they thought they had seen her, had something to report regarding her possible abduction. Well, on November 20th, the sheriff's office got a call from a farmer who said he discovered a woman's body on his property. Detectives met with the man who took him to a culvert off Interstate 20 and Norris Road and pointed into a culvert. The bottom of the culvert was the corpse of a young woman. She was half naked, but it was difficult to see at first because she was completely covered with a thick layer of mud. The corpse was taken to the morgue where the mud was hosed off. The woman appeared to be in her early 20s, about 5'5", and fit the physical appearance of the missing nurse. She had been strangled to death and, judging from her ripped clothing and half-naked appearance, sexually assaulted. She appeared to have been dead for several days, maybe as long as 2 weeks. Teresa Butler's family was notified of the discovery, and they prepared themselves for the worst. At least, as one relative pointed out, at least we'll know what happened to her. But the young woman lying covered with mud in the bottom of the culvert was not Teresa Butler. Police didn't know who she was, except she wasn't the missing nurse. Fingerprints proved that. Well, family and friends of the missing nurse were relieved, although they didn't know what happened to their friend. At least she wasn't dead. At least they didn't know if she was dead. Investigators are puzzled as well. After the search failed to turn up anything, they reasoned the girl had been kidnapped, possibly for sexual reasons. Duh. And they would eventually find her corpse tossed in the woods or along a lonely stretch of the road. So an all-points bulletin was telexed to law enforcement agencies in the immediate area. She was 26 years old, 5'3", 105 pounds, blue eyes, light brown hair, and a chickenpox scar on her right cheek. Last seen wearing a nurse's uniform and a light gray sweater. When a telex failed to turn up any leads, her name was entered into the NCIC computer that links law enforcement agencies nationwide. In December, the sheriff told a reporter he expected to eventually find a woman. He said, "It's a mighty strange case. We've got some missing person cases on the books, but nothing really like this one. Looks like she simply disappeared into thin air." Several days after the announcement, the long search appeared as if it might be coming to an end. The break came after police spoke to a man who had been sitting in a bar and struck up a conversation with another man. Fueled on beer, their conversation, of course, gravitated around the women. The guy, according to the witness, the guy told me he had lots of women, but the best one he ever had was this woman he grabbed right out of her car. He said she fought like the dickens, which made the sex even more fun. Man said he killed the woman and buried her body in the woods. According to the witness, the man finished up with "let the Smokies and the Flatfoots look all they want. They ain't never going to find her. I got her hid too well." Well, the abduction and rape and murder reportedly took place off Monterey Road in the general vicinity of where Teresa Butler's car was discovered. Lieutenant Stanley White instructed investigators to look into that lead. Well, undercover officers met with the idle boaster and pumped him for information about the woman he supposedly murdered. Afterwards, he was brought to the station where he denied killing anybody or boasting that he had. Said he didn't recall talking to anybody in a bar about murdering a woman. If he had, he must have been pig drunk. He said, that ain't like me. I got no reason to hurt women. Well, the investigators conducted a search of the man's house and 3-acre property. Search turned up nothing except discarded appliances and a few jugs of illegal moonshine. Well, the sheriff met with investigators, convinced he might be onto something more than idle talk. Made after too many beers, he ordered a massive grid search. Led by tracking dogs and deputies on all-terrain vehicles and a helicopter, 150 deputies and volunteers returned to Monterey Road and conducted another search of the area where the car had been found. This search lasted 3 days. When it was over, investigators are no closer to learning the missing nurse's whereabouts. In March of 87, Crime Stoppers ordered $1,000 for information leading to the discovery of Teresa Butler. Videotaped reenactment of the abduction was shown in the local news, along with interviews of detectives and snapshot of the victim. The family offered a $10,000 reward. Well, the search for Teresa Butler has been one of the longest, costliest, and most publicized in anybody's memory. But it wasn't the only one to catch the public's eye. On April 16, 1987, 4-year-old Marlena Childress of Union City, Tennessee, disappeared while playing in her own front yard. That prompted a massive search. Police, state, and federal agencies tracked suspects from Chicago to Memphis, where the little girl was reportedly seen in a local hair salon accompanied by two older women. Volunteer organizations held rallies and bake sales to raise a $25,000 reward for information leading to the girl's return. The rally was held in which 10,000 helium balloons with the missing child's face printed on each one was let loose in hopes that somebody might recognize the youngster. Well, despite all the searches and bake sales and dozens of leads, the little girl has never been found. Authorities also conducted a publicized search for Martha Leanne Green of White Bluff, Tennessee. Vanished after she and her twin brother ran out of gas off Interstate 40 east of Memphis. Martha stayed in the car where her brother caught a lift to a gas station. When he came back with gas, she was gone. Well, despite an exhaustive investigation by the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and countless searches, she hadn't been seen since. Shelby County detectives read through the reports and questioned investigators working these cases. Despite the fact the 4-year-old and the teenager had disappeared in mysterious circumstances, the probers could find no connection between them and the Butler case. One case that was similar was the kidnapping and murder of a nurse from Beebe, Arkansas. On April 25th, Sandra Lynn Williams left a nursing home in Quitman. She never made it. Her car was found the next day parked off a road near Romance, Arkansas. Body was discovered several days later in a ditch in Wake County. She'd been raped and shot. Shelby Sluice noticed the similarities. Both women were nurses, roughly the same age and physically similar, and both were abducted while driving home alone. The Shelby investigators contacted Arkansas authorities and told them about their case. Arkansas investigators didn't have any suspects, but agreed to keep in touch and share information. Within days, the Shelby officers were hot on another lead. On May 20th, they got a tip from a woman who said from a caller who said he had information about the Butler woman. He switched to the detective detail and spoke with one of the investigators assigned to the Butler case. He said he'd heard that a woman had been buried in a shallow grave in a 40-acre woods on the southeast corner of Rains Road and Hickory Hill. Well, the message relayed to B.D. Patterson, emergency service director, who contacted Dr. Hugh Berryman, an anthropologist who taught in the pathology department at the University of Tennessee at Memphis. Now, Berryman's a legend in the Mid-South for his ability to excavate grave sites and reconstruct crimes from the tiniest of clues. He once gained fame by reconstructing the last hours of a woman's life after studying her skeleton and a tube of toothpaste found near her corpse. Patterson told his old pal from the university about the tip. The two had been involved in 9 previous searches for the missing woman, several conducted in the area where the tipster said the body was buried. Anthropologists want to know what makes this one any different. Patterson said, got me. The detectives, though, questioned this guy pretty close and seemed convinced he's telling the truth. Well, Berryman said, that's good enough for me. Let's get going. The two pored over topographical maps and planned the search. Next morning, wearing camouflage gear and gloves to protect their hands and prevent their contaminating the crime scene, they led deputies and volunteers to an intersection of Hickory Hill and Range Road to begin the search. Berryman instructed his searchers to look for depressions, not raised mounds, explaining that soil settled when it was dug up. He told them to be aware of subtle changes in the vegetation. Dead plant in a clump might indicate somebody dug it up to hide something. Another thing to look for was plants growing in the same area but of different heights. That might indicate the growth pattern had been interrupted. And he instructed the searchers to call if they found a grave or depressed area and not to start digging on their own. He said it took experience to do an excavation, and an inexperienced digger might inadvertently destroy footprints or other physical evidence and the zeal to find the body. And one last thing, he said, be careful of snakes. Damn hot outside, we'll be up to our armpits and rattlers. Search lasted all day. Armed with machetes, the searchers battled, in addition to snakes, sweltering heat, swarms of bugs, and as they hacked through briars and brambles and poison ivy and great tangled beds of honeysuckle. Well, when it was over, they discovered the footprints of a raccoon, a dried-out crawdad hole, and a 22-inch king snake that was big enough to make a good wallet. What they didn't find was a single earth depression or change in growth pattern of plant life indicating a body had ever been buried there. Well, they were disappointed, of course. The case was 9 months old at this point. But from the public response, it could have happened yesterday. Hardly a day went by when somebody didn't call with a tip about that, about their woman. In August, police got a call from a self-described psychic who said she had a vision of the body of Teresa Butler. She said, you'll find her buried in a triangular area near a stand of pines near Houston, Levy, and Monterey Roads. Tip went back to Lieutenant White. Investigators had a steady diet of calls from psychics reporting they had seen the woman or her remains in various parts of the county. This was a little better than the others, though, so the lieutenant said, let's check it out. It might lead to something. Searchers returned to eastern Shelby County and began looking for a triangular spot where the body was supposedly buried. They didn't find it, but they had another lead by this time. A few days earlier, investigators got a call from Sheriff's Office in neighboring Hardeman County. 22-year-old mechanic and police reservist had been returned to the jail in Bolivar, charged with impersonating an officer and abducting a nurse. Hardeman detective said he flat out admitted it. Said he did the same thing in your neck of the woods, only that time he killed her. Suspect was Ben Boyd, 22, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. Been arrested 3 times that summer, including once for rape in Shelby County. He was first arrested on June 1st by Germantown police after a woman told officers he was following her after she left work. When police stopped him, Boyd reported a leap from his car and flashed a Shelby County Sheriff's badge saying he's working undercover. One of the officers taking down the report glanced on the back seat and noticed a shotgun. Ran a driver's license check and saw Boyd wasn't listed by the computer as a law enforcement officer. When this was brought to Boyd's attention, he admitted he was a reservist. Further investigative work revealed he was actually a former reservist who'd entered a reserve class in November of 86 and was dismissed the following spring for poor attendance. He was arrested and charged with impersonating an officer. Badge was confiscated and he was booked in the county jail. But he got released that same day. A week later, he's back in jail on a charge of rape. Female employee at St. Francis Hospital said she woke up at 4:30 in the morning after falling asleep on her couch and saw a man standing in the bedroom. Showed her a gun, handcuffed her to the bed, and raped her. Trying to talk the man out of the rape, she learned he was acquainted with the neighborhood and even knew some of the people who lived there. Boyd was picked up after police learned he had an old girlfriend who once lived in the neighborhood. He denied raping the girl, but was arrested after the victim picked him out of a lineup. He got released on a $10,000 bond. The next crime entry was July 22nd. A woman told police she was on her way home and she was stopped by a man in the Shelby County Sheriff's uniform. Man told her she was under arrest for speeding. Told her to lock her car and go with him. Now, she suspected someone right because the man wasn't in uniform, or a complete uniform, and reeked of alcohol. But she followed him anyway. He tried to put the cuffs on her, and when she objected, he stuck a gun to the side of her head and said, "Do what I say or I'll blow you away." Well, she didn't do what he wanted. Instead, she let out a blood-curdling scream that made a passing motorist screech to a halt. The phony cop jumped in his car and took off. Woman reported the incident to the sheriff's office. She picked Boyd out of lineup as the man that pulled her over. Well, police began receiving reports from other counties about a man posing as a police officer and pulling over female residents. In each county, in each incident, the man was out of uniform but wore a dark blue huffy police-style jacket and carried a badge. Drove an unmarked car, but they stopped because he had a blue frickling dash light, like the type Kojak used on his TV show. Investigators met with Lieutenant White. One officer said that flickering blue light might explain why Ms. Butler got out of her car. Thought she was talking to a real cop. And White agreed, said she had no reason to believe he wasn't a real cop. Well, the officers also noted the rape and two of the illegal stops occurred near St. Francis Hospital, where Teresa Butler was last seen alive and where Boyd's former girlfriend used to live. And the crimes also were committed during the evening, about the time Teresa Butler left for home. Investigators went to Shelby County Jail to question Boyd. Since his return from Hardeman County, the bogus reserves officer hired an attorney and refused to discuss the Butler case or anything he had said during regarding her disappearance. Police still had his confession, though. He had said he kidnapped a young nurse, raped, murdered, and disposed of her body in the woods. He didn't know exactly where in the woods. He said it was under a pile of leaves in a triangular area near a stand of birch trees. Well, investigators then got a tip from a self-described psychic who said she had followed the story and had a vision of the body of Teresa Butler. She said you'll find her body near Houston, Levy, and Monterey Road. Searchers went to the area and began looking for a triangular area near a stand of birch trees. The area had been covered in some of the other searches and was as familiar to some of the detectives as her own backyard. But, as they said, one more search couldn't hurt. As deputies and volunteers conducted their grid search, detectives searched Boyd's home in Ayrshire Cove and wooded area that adjoined it. They found nothing to link him to the murder. Well, the search in Monterey Road lasted 5 days. Deputies found a rotted and white blouse and an umbrella, neither of which belonged to the missing nurse, but no sign of the body or the triangular spot by the stand of trees. The sheriff told reporters, "We found no tangible evidence to link our suspect to the case. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but we just couldn't find it." Assistant District Attorney General John Perioti said that without a body, it'd be impossible to press additional criminal charges against Boyd. "It's possible to prosecute when the victim is never found," he admitted, "but not in this instance. We need a body, and we don't have one." Well, on December 10th, 1987, Ben Boyd got a 5-year sentence after pleading guilty to 4 charges arising from the attempted abduction of a St. Francis Hospital employee. Since recanting his confession, he said nothing about Teresa Butler, and no charges have been filed against him in this regard. Now, the sad thing is, no matter how detailed investigation might be, no matter how many searches are conducted, sometimes you can be off by 10 feet and not see the grave at all. And some of these killers, when they dispose of the body, are very meticulous in how they do it. And while I have seen psychics who are very accurate in the information they give, in a number of other cases, it doesn't give you what you're looking for. You know, I've got dozens of unsolved murder cases. And we're going to be covering most of them as we go along. Now, November is an interesting month. Of course, with the Thanksgiving holidays coming up, there'll be a lot of people on the road. And quite often, you have families on trips mysteriously disappear. While people are on their trips, others who know them find out they're gone, break in their homes, steal. It's an unfortunate fact that it's very, very difficult to anticipate the lengths to which some people will stoop in order to unjustly enrich themselves. Quite often, those who break in homes will watch the obituaries for when funerals are going to happen. And the home of the deceased, since everyone's going to be at the funeral, is quite often broken into. Now, we also have home invasions on the rise. I was reading about one the other day. The homeowner was a lady in her 80s, and two young men broke in, and she shot one as he came through the door and shot the second one, who died out in the yard. Now, whenever a weapon is, such as a gun, is used for somebody to defend himself, there's always some enthusiastic hotshot that wants to prosecute him for murder or manslaughter. But generally, if someone breaks into your home and you are there and you defend yourself, even if you use deadly force, that's not considered... Yes, it's a homicide, but it's not murder. Though if the district attorney doesn't like you, he will charge you anyway. Even though he knows you're going to get off, he knows it will cost you tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees. And he gets to laugh up his sleeve about the fact that he got back at you. I could tell you stories. Well, we've come to the end of another show. And since this is Friday night, we will not be back until Monday. But until Monday at 6 p.m. Mountain, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.